Welcome to Unique Connections at the Table. I'm Dr. Beverly Samways, and each episode we invite you to join the conversation and discover new ways of seeing the world, particularly in relation to those with learning disabilities. So pull up a chair, the table's set, and we're so glad you're here.
Hello, how are you?
I'm all right, thanks, mate. How are you doing?
I am good, thank you. I had a birthday last week, which is always great. And the joy is you did too.
We did, 2 days apart, which is super fun. How was your birthday, Jen?
I have like this weird, I used to celebrate my birthday all month. So I used to do something special every day that I was like, it's birthday month. If I want to buy these flowers, I'm going to buy them because it's birthday month. It's almost like having a birthday just gives me permission and it kind of informs that whole month for me. How was yours?
Yeah, mine was, you know, I think I do the same because the amount of packages that came in last week from Amazon, but I wasn't conscious that I was buying more things because of my birthday, but it must have been. My actual birthday in the day was really nice. I had like different friends that I went for, like went for breakfast with a friend and then for lunch and dinner. I was having a really lovely day. And then one of these things that I'd had ordered was, I don't know if you've seen the like the under the kitchen sink water filters that are supposed to act like an amazing water filter for your drinking water. So I was really excited about this. It came, it looks so like fancy. And all the blurbs, it's like 15 minutes just to set it up. So I was like, oh, I'm going to set it up. And then I've got lovely clean water for the rest of my birthday. So I start messing about under the kitchen sink. I'm definitely overconfident when it comes to like any kind of DIY. I always think, yeah, they'll be fine. So anyway, long story short, the kitchen was flooded. Like the U-bend on the sink felt like the waste pipe fell off. It was stinking. Like, oh, it was such a nightmare. And I had this thing, of course, where, like, obviously it's a nightmare situation, but inside I'm like, on my birthday, how dare they? And I was and then I was like, I just ring customer services. No, they don't have a phone, they have an email. So I'm emailing the woman, like, you know, I mean, it's hard to be really ragey over an email, but basically incensed that this is happening to me and assuming that she just knows it's my birthday. Like, how can they let this happen on my birthday? And of course they don't know it's my birthday. The underwater filter doesn't know it's my birthday, although I feel like it should know. And if something happens, isn't it, when there's like a significant moment in our lives, and even though there's no reason why anyone would know that, we expect people to know these things about us, and we feel incensed that when they don't, and when these things are allowed to happen. It's quite a strange process.
I remember being like the first bereavement I had as a teenager was when my granddad died, and I remember walking up the road. I was probably 16 or so, and walking past somebody and being so angry that they didn't stop me and say, I'm sorry your granddad's died. I'd never seen this person before. As far as I know, they hadn't known my granddad. But I was like, is it not like tattooed across my face?
Yeah.
And it reminds me of that old poem, the like, stop all the clocks.
Stop the clocks.
Yeah, it's that kind of, why is the whole world not responding to what's going on for me right now? It's so clear to me that things are not okay.
Yeah.
Or birthday, they are okay. It's so clear to me there's something. Why are you not all responding?
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. And that must be, right, the experience of lots of the young people that we support and that we work with through Unique Connections who have had life-changing, life-altering events happening. And they can't verbalise it. They can't tell the story. But just like, I expect people to know that the kitchen should not flood on my birthday. You expect a stranger to know that your grandpa has passed away. And so, you know, it would be completely ordinary for a young person to expect those around them to know that they have particular fears or they have particular things that just that should happen or shouldn't happen, regardless of whether we actually know that or not.
And it reminds me of you said last week around when you'd had a young person that you were working with as a team, you sat down and you talked about their story.
And
you saw some of the things that came to light that made you think, oh yeah, actually this may well be impacting this. But so often some of the young people that we work with or some of the organisations that we work with, we don't know the full story.
No.
We don't know everything. And the young person may well have not had the language put upon it that if they are able to communicate about it, to have those words as well.
Yeah.
To have that.
Absolutely.
Okay, yeah, this thing happened and I felt frightened and now I feel frightened every time this thing happens because of that.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's worth going digging for that story, isn't it? Like, it's worth trying to find it if we can. But actually, sometimes we can't. Sometimes we might suspect that a young person is having a trauma response or something has gone wrong. But we don't know. We just don't know the story. I remember years ago working with a young lad who was deaf and blind and no verbal communication. And he went through a phase where he would freeze, just go into a complete freeze state. So he'd curl on the ball and on the floor, and he would, you know, he just wouldn't move. You could not move him for anything. And I think as we took some time to just sit with him and listen, you could hear that he was frightened because of the noises that he was making. And we had no way of knowing what had happened to him, that he was, I think he must have been having a flashback. But we had no way of knowing what that flashback was or what it related to or what was triggering it. We couldn't solve any of those problems, but we could just sit with him rather than trying to, like, putting in a behaviour plan, I guess, or trying to, like, oh, he shouldn't just drop, that's not safe, like, all of that sort of stuff, like, he needs to move. Just being like, okay, for whatever reason, he's frightened. So, so let's do everything we can to be with him in those moments and to help him not to feel unsafe. And they did stop over time, but we never understood what they were about. And I guess that is some of the principle around trauma-informed care that I went to find out about, and why it's so like appropriate, particularly for services that are working with young people with intellectual disabilities, and most particularly with those who have little or no spoken communication, because there's like a general principle that implementing the principles of trauma-informed care can help to heal trauma in a person, even if we don't know what or where or how it is. And if the other thing that's really important for trauma-informed care is that if it's implemented and, you know, let's say there's nobody that's traumatised, there's like no one's traumatised, but we're putting trauma-informed care in place, like if that was ever going to happen in a learning disability organisation, which it isn't, then it won't do any harm. It will still have like significant benefits for everybody across all levels. So it's at the worst it can do, like it's benign at worst. Do you know what I mean? Like it's never going to do any harm. And chances are it's going to have a really significant impact and help to restore safety for people, even if we don't know why and what has caused them to have that adaptive response of having a fear response to their world.
The way that we approach trauma and trauma-informed care in the UK is different to how it's approached in America, or what you saw when you were out.
Yeah, so that was partly what I went out to find out, really. So I don't think that, like, what is happening in the US in terms of, say, would say, like, intellectual disability services, I don't know that it's, like, it's different, but I don't know that it's, like, better on every level. There were definitely places that I went to that I felt like were better resourced in the UK. We're doing some things better. I would say like the sort of therapy space, like speech and language therapy and OT and those kinds of things is probably more universalised in the UK than it is in the US. But so I don't know that the, like, in terms of intellectual disabilities services, they are radically better than the UK. But what is culturally different in the US is conversations and the normalisation of talking about trauma. That is very different. So in the UK, I always get the impression when you talk about trauma-informed care, particularly as it's becoming more common in different sectors, that everybody's kind of rolling their eyes and going, oh, it's not everybody's traumatised. Just get over it. Come on. Like,
you know, I would have been fine if that happened to me. They don't need that. I have this. I lived in a box. You know, that kind of thing.
Exactly. And I think that's a reflection of, like, the people that have been leading on trauma-informed care in the UK is pretty exclusively psychotherapists. Like, those are the ones that have been talking about it for decades, have been promoting, like, trauma-informed work for, like, really, really long time. But what we do, and maybe that's also the true in the US, but what's different is our attitude culturally to therapy and therapists. So in the UK, it's seen as like maybe a bit, because we've got this like culture of like, just get on with it. Like that sort of wartime mentality, like stiff upper lip, just crack on. Like, you know, you can just, you don't need therapy. You can, you know, just get a gym membership and, you know.
Have a bubble bath.
Go for a walk. Exactly. Yeah. All of that. There's a lot of cynicism towards therapists and therefore to therapeutic approaches in the UK. Whereas in the US, if you think about, like, everyone's always talking about going to therapy, and we laugh about it in the UK, don't we? Like, there's probably no public figure in the US that hasn't got a therapist. Like, it's just so standardised. And lots of people have had therapy in the US. It's normal. It's not a weird thing to say, I go to therapy. Whereas in the UK, it feels like, that it's unusual. And I know that, you know, for you and I, when I remember we were at a conference a little while back and somebody was like, oh, how do we get to that space where, like, we were talking about staying regulated with young people. We were both like, therapy, go to therapy. And you can see the whole audience going, no, we're not going to go to therapy.
Yeah. And even as a therapist, the number of people that are like, I'm coming to therapy, but I don't actually want therapy. I just want you to give me the tools to be able to do this.
Right.
That kind of thing. I don't want a relationship. Right. I just want you to say, here you are, do these five things and everything's going to be fine.
Yeah, because we can do learning, can't we? That's why we love a bit of CBT.
Yeah.
I'm learning some principles, I'm learning some tools. But don't therapize me. Yeah. That's basically...
Yeah. And that's different. That's different in America.
It's very different. And so there's not the cynicism or the eye rolling to something like the principle of trauma-informed care. And that means that as a culture, they're much more open and they're much further along. So the reason I went out there is so they have these big trauma institutes like all across the UK that work with organisations to implement trauma-informed care. And that is that's a fairly normal thing for an organisation to do. It's not that everybody's doing it by any stretch. But it is far, far more usual. And within the other, it's interesting within the intellectual disability service, because it's far more usual for services to bring in trauma informed care. And they have, so how they would understand it in the US. So when we say if we say in the UK, the school is trauma informed, what they generally mean is, the school has had a couple of days of training and they've learned about polyvagal theory, ACEs and trauma and how it presents.
Or we've sent one person on a course.
Yeah.
And nobody's told back to what they've said.
Right, exactly. And that is not what they mean in the US. essentially talking about an organisational change piece. Now, that's another cultural difference, because the idea that an organisation would go through an organisational change process is, again, far more normal thinking. So I remember talking to a guy from Sarah Reed, which is a service provider for all sorts of a human services organisation in Pennsylvania. And we were talking about this process. I was talking about some organisations like resistance to beginning to go down a bit of a process around TIC. And he was like, well, what did they do last time they did organisational change? And I was like, what are you talking about? We're not all doing organisational change in the UK. And he was like, oh, are you not? Like, so it's far more common, maybe because of the size of the organisations, that they would continually have like an evaluation process. They would think like, what do we need? What do we need to implement across the board? And so these sorts of big pieces of work organisationally are more common. It's, and then the idea that we would, like across the board, we would bring in a whole new ethos for an organisation under trauma-informed care it's already there. They're like primed for it. And then I think legislatively it's different. So there's entire states. So I think across New York State, which is an enormous state, if you're running human services, you have to have implemented trauma-informed care as an organisational change piece. Like you have to have, they will close you down if you haven't done it. So that, you have to, it has to be accredited through an institute. So it's really, it's really, and they're not talking about 2 days training. They're talking about, you know, that the entire workforce of the organisation goes through a process of understanding and then embedding trauma-informed care principles into every single layer of an organisation, like over a course of this. So the trauma-informed care institutes that I went to 3 institutes. And the sorts of programs that they're running would typically operate over 2 to 3 years of a journey with an organisation. So we can already see the difference in terms of thinking about a day or a couple of days training for senior managers, as opposed to a 2 to 3 year process for organisational change to embed trauma-informed care as a philosophy. So before I go on to talk about that, just any thoughts in terms of like culture and shift and all that kind of stuff.
There is a greater need in the USA, and that is why they are implementing this.
Oh, that's a really good question.
The need is the same as the UK. It's just that they have taken a different approach.
Yeah, I think the need is the same. So they have a really similar history. So I remember one of the spaces I went to was in Chattanooga. I went to a autism service, and he began to tell me about like the history of institutionalization of people with intellectual disabilities and autism, like this would be new news to me. And he shows me some pictures, and he says, oh, this is what we used to do with people with intellectual disabilities in the US, and it's and we have to keep hold of that history and remember it and remember the wrong that was done, and there's been a lot of work put in to recovering from that. And
that's fascinating, isn't it? Because I've never heard that approach in organizations within the UK.
No, that's right, because of course we have the same history here in the UK, but we tend to feel, you know, just like embarrassed and shameful about it. We wouldn't have. So they had an enormous display cabinet that tracked the history of people with autism and intellectual disabilities in the state. And this was the story they were telling as a way of holding the history of the wrong done and ensuring, you know, a bit like how we would use Remembrance Day. So, yeah, that was different. But the history is the same. The damage done is the same. The legacy of that is the same. And then, like, it is so different out there. Like, obviously, because the way that things are funded is through insurance, and that has a whole load of different criteria, which means that some things get more money than other things. So the other odd thing is that, like, ABA, so applied behavioral analysis, is massive in the US and it's really not in the UK. So that's the, I would say that's the flip side. So ABA is a highly behavioral, a very rigid form of trying to teach somebody, particularly young people with autism, how to unlearn particular traits or responses to things.
Is ABA very... won't be organisational in the same way.
What, say that again.
So I guess my curiosity is, we've talked about organisations having a trauma-informed approach.
Yeah.
In trauma-informed care through institutes, those kind of things, that that the whole organisation has this as part of organisational change.
Yeah.
Are you saying that that wouldn't happen with ABA? ABA would be a, on the ground, we take an ABA approach.
And I don't,
have both?
Yeah, there is some attempt to bring ABA and trauma-informed care together, but they are like oil and water, in my opinion. So there tends to be more like there's ABA clinics where a child will go into an ABA clinic, sometimes for like 40 hours a week. It's a lot. Like, they'll do that rather than school, and have this sort of very rigid training approach. There must be services that are simultaneously running ABA and also trauma-informed care. I don't quite know. There's that it's incongruent to me. So yeah, that is a tension, definitely. And that was the bit. So we would, you know, most services in the UK use positive behaviour support. So positive behaviour support is an evolution of ABA. So it came out of ABA, but it's it's more like a framework for understanding behaviour that's difficult or that causes difficulty for the person or for the people around them. That was very different as well. But I think, so not everything I saw in the US is transferable into the UK. And I think that's where the report lands, saying, like, you know, because of the cultural differences, you can't just pull everything. Like, I mean, there are some schools that have taken on the packages of the institutes in the UK, but they are few and far between, because I think it's not easily translatable. But I do think there is something that's translatable into the UK that's similar. It just needs reworking and rethinking. But I think, yeah, the influence of the work done around trauma, around therapy and around these trauma institutes is really radical in the US. And is making, is like very much like normalising, building human services organisations on the basis of safety, which is everything that we are thinking about and wanting to do, really.
What difference do you think you noticed compared to the UK, sort of in practice? What was different?
So I didn't get to go to as many service providers as I would have wanted to. So I spent more time with like trauma institutes, learning how they were implementing this. And there was, they did say it was harder for them to get into the human service providers who were caring for people with intellectual disabilities. There was still a barrier there, just as there is in the UK, that, like, you know, probably most mainstream schools have had something around trauma by now, but you cannot say that about the learning disability sector. There's definitely schools who have not touched it, and that's probably a similar trait in the US. I think I definitely saw in those places that I was able to go to, I definitely saw a really clear understanding around how safety is embedded. And I think this is the shift. This is like the mental shift that we have to make when we really embrace trauma-informed care, that this is not just about the young people. Like it's a whole organisational piece. So what, you know, one of the things that all the institutes, TIC programmes have in common is that safety, the principle of safety, has to be implemented all the way through. So the first thing they do, I was with an organisation actually in the UK that is doing this, and the first thing they were doing is they were bringing together all of their maintenance team, their catering staff, their housekeepers, and those that had no administrators, so those that had no direct work with the young people at all. And this particular school was delivering 5 days of training around the principles of trauma-informed care to their staff who had no direct, it was not their job to give direct support to any of the young people. This is their starting point, that everybody across the organisation firstly understands and then experiences the principles of trauma-informed care. And I guess if I sort of just pull back and think about how any of, like, this is really about sustainability and about how we all operate. So if I'm asking, so if we take, the five principles are safety, trustworthiness, choice, collaboration, and empowerment. But I tell you, and none of those feel particularly radical, but they are radical when we start to treat them as an organisational process. So what tends to happen in terms of choice is there won't be a learning disability service in the UK that isn't talking about promoting choice with the young people that they support. What that tends to happen is that the direct support staff are told you must allow the child a choice, and so the direct support workers, maybe they find a way to say, like, which t-shirt do you want to wear today, or like they're looking for a way to evidence that they have given the child choice. But at the level of the staff member, do they experience any choice? So maybe whilst they're being told to promote choice, their choices are eviscerated. So they're told, these are the shifts you have to work during these times. I don't care whether it fits around the rest of your life. This is how it works. And if we're understaffed, I'm going to call you in on your day off. And that isn't a choice either. And maybe these are the sorts of clothes you have to wear. If you don't show up in the right clothes, I'll send you home to get changed. This is when you eat your dinner and this is where you eat it. And so the choices of the direct support staff are limited to in a way that restricts and disempowers them and makes them feel like they are not valued. And within that context and that experience, and I don't think I'm exaggerating when I list those sorts of things where a direct care support worker doesn't have choice. Within that experience where their choice is being radically limited, they are expected to promote the choice of the person that they're caring for. And you can see how that isn't going to work. Like, that's going to feel like really punitive and it just can't be sustained. So when TIC says choice is a principle that needs, they're not saying what we say in the UK, which is that a person with a learning disability needs choice. They're saying choice has to be embedded all the way through the organisation. So as much as is possible, the maintenance staff feel that they have a choice about things and their choices will be listened to and respected as far as possible. That that if a direct support worker says, I don't want to do this, or can we talk about this, or can I express an opinion about this, they will be listened to. And that for a middle manager, that they will have choice about and flexibility, and they will be respected and listened to. Once that gets embedded all the way through an organisation, we have a fighting chance that a young person with learning disabilities will have their choices promoted, because it feels like it's an ethos, it's a culture, it's a value. It's not a direction. Do you know what I mean? At the moment, like, you must give this young person choice, but your choice is no, you don't get them. And that, it feels unjust, it feels unfair. But when we embed it all the way through, you don't have to say, if the direct support worker feels respected, collaborated with, and that their choices are listened to, you don't really have to tell them to promote the choice of the person they're looking after, because it's gotten into the atmosphere, into the air, into the culture. And I guess that's what this whole piece is about. And that's why, and we'll maybe come on to this next week, like, how does that actually happen? That it isn't predominantly through training sessions. Like, you can't learn, an organisation cannot change and adapt and learn predominantly through sitting on a Zoom and being trained. There has to be something that intentionally gets built and embedded in to a setting where the values shift and the mission statement shifts and the ethos shifts and the policies shift and the everything that operates within the organisation gets moved so that these principles become going, they go through the bloodstream of the organisation.
I'm looking forward to us talking about this more, because I'm really interested in and how this looked in practice.
Yeah.
Because it feels like over a whole country level, it feels like we are so very, very far away.
Mm.
And I imagine if we also look at the whole of the USA, it feels like as a whole, they are also very far away from every organisation having this.
Not,
I mean, we're not seeing that at all, are we?
No.
But that feeling of what it looks like for each of these values to come into our work, and therefore, what does that enable us to be able to offer the organisations it is that we work with?
Yeah.
And therefore, what difference is it that it's making to these young people?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's, you know, they've got the framework and the mechanisms set up in the US. And that was what I saw. Okay. Like, how far are they along the route, particularly in our sector, of this actually getting embedded? I'd say that is still they are struggling with that in the US, but they're still ahead of us. So there's lots to be learnt. But yeah, let's think about that next time. Yeah. Great.
Thanks so much for listening today. Before you go, can you help us with something? We want to make sure these conversations reach the people who need to hear them. So if there's someone you think would benefit from listening to this, we would just love it if you shared it. See you next time.